All right, HSM, how we doing tonight? Good. Hey, I love the fact that we like squeezed in. This is awesome. I feel so much closer to everyone. I don't have to keep, you know, I'll talk to y'all, okay, but I don't have to keep, you know, get a whatever crick in your neck from doing all that stuff. So I like it. Hey, if you're new tonight, we are so glad that you're here. We want you to feel super welcome, and there's probably a lot going on. There is a lot going on. You don't have to know everything. We don't know everything, but we have a lot of fun doing it. So we're glad you're here. Worship was awesome. Thank you guys for that. Had a lot of fun. You can get over to the worship team again. So you'll have to excuse me. I have some allergies. I don't know if it's that I'm getting sick or if my body's adjusting to living out in California, but I am losing my voice every single night right around 7 o'clock, which stinks because it's 6:40. So there's a good chance that I will lose my voice halfway through the message tonight. If that happens, we'll have some of you all, Mia, you're going to come up and preach for me if that happens. So, but hey, I don't have, I'm really excited about tonight. I don't have a crazy creative intro to my message because we don't have a ton of time to cover everything that I want to cover. I'm really excited about it. I told my team this morning I was going through my message, and about halfway through, the Lord revealed something to me that I hadn't even thought of yet. So I completely stripped down my message and rewrote about half of it. So I'm really excited because it's from God, and I'm excited. So I'm just going to dive right in. So if you haven't been here, or if you've missed a couple weeks, like Jordan said earlier, we are in our series called Seasons, talking about seasons of life, the seasons of change. They're up, they're down, they come, they go. They're hot, they're cold, they're good, they're great, they're terrible. It's all over the place, and it always happens. No matter what you're doing in life, there's always going to be different seasons of change that we face. And we get that idea of seasons from our theme verse, which is Isaiah 48. The grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever. It'd be helpful if I could remember our theme verse. But so we're talking about the seasons of change, the grass withers, the flower fades. But the one true form of consistency comes from God's word and his love. So that's what we're talking about. The first week we talked about preparing for change. We know it's coming, so we need to prepare for it. We compared it to a rainstorm. When we prepare for the rain, it brings vegetation, it brings fruit, it brings life to our lives. But when we don't prepare for it, the rain comes in and it floods everything that we had in place. When we're not ready for it, it completely destroys our lives. So it's important to prepare for the change. The second thing we talked about is looking for the opportunities within the change. Rather than focusing on how I'm going to get through this season, focus on what God is doing in you and through the season. What can you get out of it? What can I do while I'm in it? You're in the season of change. Don't take it for granted. Look for the opportunities within. And then last week, we talked a little bit about going to God in the season of change. We talked about identity. We talked about purpose. We talked about living a life for God and to God and going to him in the season of change because that's where our foundation is. So that's what we've talked about, and we've been focusing on a guy named Joseph. Joseph has a crazy up and down story, exemplifies change pretty well, so that's what we've been focusing on, and I'm going to try to recap his story as quick as I can, so stay with me. So he's a brother of 12, second to youngest. He was the favorite, and I didn't go into too much detail about this, but I'm going to because it's important for tonight. He was the second youngest, but he was the favorite. The reason he was the favorite is that all of his older brothers were born not of his mother and not of his father's wife. So his father and his mother, they were infertile together. They couldn't have kids, so they brought in like surrogates, and they brought in other girls to have their kid. That was a thing that they did back then. But then Joseph comes along. He's the miracle child. He's the child that was born of his true father and mother. So his dad loved him the best. And then they had another son. And another son plays a big role in tonight's story. So that's why I mentioned that. But Joseph got this awesome coat, dripping swag, like I said last week. It was a coat of many colors, and it basically symbolized his favor over his life from his dad. His brothers hated him for it. And then he got these dreams from God saying that one day he was going to rule over his brothers and his father, so his brothers hated him even more. So they threw him into a pit, sold him into slavery. While he was in slavery, he was accused of rape, got thrown into prison for something he didn't do. While he was in prison, he interpreted some dreams. Then Pharaoh had a dream. He interpreted Pharaoh's dreams. And then he got made basically the second most powerful man in the world. And that's what we've covered. Did I cover everything? Does that sound about right? Cool. You don't have to roll tight. You don't have to clap for that. But so that's where we're at. So basically where we left off last week is that he just got out of prison and he told Pharaoh, hey, here's what your dreams mean. Your dreams mean that there's going to be 7 years of plenty. There's going to be 7 years where it rains all the time and you got sunshine coming in too. And you're going to grow a ton of wheat and vegetables and fruit. And it's going to be incredible. You're going to have so much abundance. Then it's going to be followed up by 7 years of famine. And what he advised Pharaoh, what you need to do is you need to take someone. And during that 7 years of plenty, you need to store one-fifth of everything, one-fifth of all your food, everything, so that when the famine comes, you'll have plenty of food to feed Egypt and to feed the rest of the world. So where we left off was that the 7 years came, Joseph got put in charge of that, of the storing the one-fifth, and then the famine came, and it says that the entire world came to Joseph to buy food. So we pick up tonight 2 years into the famine. Does everyone get where we're at? There's been 7 years of plenty. Now it's in the famine, it's 2 years in, and Joseph is in charge of giving food to the rest of the world. All of Egypt and the entire area around it is coming to him to buy food so that they don't die. Now, that's where we're going to pick up, but the story tonight changes perspectives. It's like we've been watching a movie, and we've been following Joseph's story all the way. He started in Canaan, got in the pit, slavery, prison, all that stuff, and it's followed him, and it's been on him in Egypt. And tonight, in the same time frame, we take that focus off of him and go back to the land of Canaan, where his brothers and his father are. So tonight's story focuses on his brothers. And so we pick up in chapter 42, verse 2 through 4, and this is his father speaking to his 10 older brothers back in Canaan. He said to them, "Behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go down, buy grain for us there, that we may live and not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt, but Jacob did not let Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen. Remember, they're all his brothers, but the 10 older ones are his half-brothers. Benjamin, his little brother, is his full brother. And now that Joseph's gone, his father, Jacob, is so protective over Benjamin, he doesn't want to let him out of his sight. So he sends his other 10 brothers to Egypt so that they don't die. Verse 6 through 9, "And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground." They had no idea who Joseph was. They came and they thought he was just some Egyptian dude who was in charge of the food, like this royal big high up guy. They had no idea who this guy was, because you got to think it's probably been about 15 years, because it's been 9 years since Joseph's been in this position. Before that, it was at least 2 years in prison. The Bible says it was at least 2 years, probably a good 4 or 5 years actually. Then before that, he was a slave for a couple of years. And then before that, he was with his brother. So it's probably been about 15, 20 years. So they have no idea that this guy's alive. So why would you think that that's your brother? They had no idea. So they didn't recognize him, but it says this, "Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them." He saw them, recognized them, and also recognized that they had no idea who he was. So he decides to play along. He decides, "I don't want to quite yet reveal who I am, so I'm going to play along." He starts playing the part. He starts speaking roughly to them because he's acting like an Egyptian, and an Egyptian would have spoken roughly to him. So he says, "Where do you guys come from?" They said, "Well, we're from the land of Canaan. We're here to buy food." And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. So it says twice in that verse that he recognized them, which sounds repetitive, but the fact that it mentions it twice actually hints at, according to some scholars, it hints at the fact that Joseph was actually excited to see his brothers. Who in their right minds is excited to see the people that throw you into slavery? Right? If my brothers sold me into slavery, the last emotion that I could think of to see them would be excited. And yet it says that Joseph was happy to see him. In fact, so much so that he immediately starts devising a plan where he's going to extend this interaction beyond just selling them grain, beyond just the swap of goods, and then sends them on the way. He starts thinking of a plan. "I'm going to extend this interaction between me and my brothers." And he's actually going to set them up to test them. Remember, we talked about looking for the opportunities within the trials. Joseph sees an opportunity and says, "I'm not just going to get revenge. I don't want that. I see an opportunity. I'm going to take advantage of it." So he pretends to be just an Egyptian guy. And in verse 9 through 10, it says this. He said to them, "You're spies. You've come to see the nakedness of the land." And they said to him, "No, my lord, we're not. We're just here to buy food." Joseph accuses them of being spies in order to extend this interaction, right? He's trying to keep the conversation going, and he's setting up for a dramatic reveal. He wants to test his brother. So he accuses them of spies, and they're like, "No, we're not." And they said, "We're your servants. We're 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. Behold, the youngest right now is with our father, and one is no more. Now, they're talking about Joseph here. To Joseph, although they don't know it, but they're saying, we have a little brother, he's with our dad, and we have another brother, and he's dead. He's dead. And Joseph's like, no. But so they're talking to Joseph. They think he's dead. They're like, no, our brother's back home, and one of them's dead. We see here also, this is just a little side note that I picked up on, Joseph has completely let go of his past at this point, and it's evident because Joseph gets caught off guard by this interaction. And I don't know about you, but if I'm still holding on to my past, I am waiting for the day that I finally get to stand in front of my brothers and say, ha, like, I look at me now, like, you sold me into slavery. Remember that coat? I got 9 of them now. Like, what's up? But he doesn't. It says he's caught off guard by this, so he's not waiting for that day. In fact, he even forgot about what his brothers did to him and was so focused on what God has presented him with that when his brothers come, he's caught off guard by it, right? So what he does is he throws him into prison for 3 days, and I know what you're thinking. You're like, well, you just said he wasn't trying to get revenge, and he's not. He throws him into prison in order, once again, to extend the interaction and to think, what am I going to do here? So he accuses him of being spies, throws him into prison, so now he can take a step back and say, all right, here's what I want to do. He can plan it out, gets out the chalkboard. All right, if this works out, whatever. Plans the whole thing. Now, he probably enjoyed it. I'm not saying he didn't enjoy it. I probably would have a couple laughs, like, finally got these guys back there in prison. But that wasn't the purpose of throwing him into prison. He doesn't have an ill-conceived plan for this. He just throws him into prison to think about it. So verse 18 through 20 says, on the third day, Joseph said to them, do this and you'll live, for I fear God, once again giving God the credit. If you're an honest man, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are, and the rest of you can go. You can take the grain, you can have your food, but bring back your youngest brother to me so your words will be verified and you shall not die. So basically, he comes with his plan. He's like, I'm going to tell them that it's to prove that they're not spies, but really, I'm setting them up to test them because he wants to find out how they feel about his little brother. Have these guys changed? Or do these guys hate my little brother like they hate me? I'm going to find out. So he says, one of you stay here in prison, the rest of you go back, bring food, and then bring back your little brother. So that's what he does. He tells them, and they start talking amongst themselves. They're like, what are we going to do about this? How do we feel? Do we agree? Do we try to fight our way out? Whatever they do. But they talk about it in front of Joseph in Hebrew, thinking that Joseph doesn't understand Hebrew because he's just some Egyptian dude. Little do they know, he's actually a Hebrew too. He just knows how to speak whatever they speak in Egypt. I don't know what they speak. But so they start talking amongst themselves in Hebrew, thinking that he doesn't understand. In verse 21 through 22, they said to one another, in truth, we're guilty concerning our brother and that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged and we didn't listen. Once again, they're talking about Joseph. They're talking about what they did to Joseph all those years ago. That's why this distress has come upon us. And Reuben answered them, that's one of the brothers, did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But did you not listen? No. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood. They're saying, we did all that stuff. What goes around comes around, karma, whatever you want to call it. Because we did that to Joseph so many years ago, now we're going through this trial. It all makes sense. They're talking about it, and they're remorseful, and they regret it, and all this stuff. And this is a really significant moment, right? Because their guilty attitudes shows that they're remorseful for what they did to Joseph. They regret it. And Joseph is listening to this whole interaction between them, and it says that he becomes overwhelmed with emotion and has to leave and weep. It says that he left and wept. And that word used for weep doesn't just mean cry. It's an exaggerated form of the word, meaning it's that helpless, screaming, crying. Have you ever had a moment where it's just like you're overwhelmed with emotion and you got to cry, but you don't even know what to cry about? And it's just like, I just don't know. You know, that kind of thing where you like catch your breath. Now, you know what I'm talking about? It's like that kind of cry. It's like, excuse me. It's like every time I watch Old Yeller. Has anyone ever seen Old Yeller? Anyone who hasn't seen Old Yeller or know what it, okay, cool. Has anyone seen Marley and Me? Y'all know Marley and Me? Ooh. Picture Marley and Me, but like 10 times worse. Because, so it's this guy, they live on, like, it's like olden times when they still have like muskets or whatever, I don't know. But this kid gets a golden retriever and it's like his best friend. He loves him so much. They love each other. They go on all these adventures together. Towards the end of the movie, a wolf attacks the boy, trying to kill him, trying to eat him, I guess. And the dog comes in and saves the day and fights off this wolf and kills the wolf. And it's like, yes, that was awesome. And like they love each other again, but the dog limps off. Turns out that the wolf had rabies. So now the dog has rabies. So the kid has to shoot and kill his best friend in the entire world. I'm talking ugly cry every time I watch it. I get emotional just thinking about it. It's just like, I don't know what to do, you know. It's awful. But it's that kind of emotion that it says that Joseph has here. Does that make sense? Where it's just overwhelmed, it's sweaty, it's just, you can't even stand up, kind of cry. It's an overwhelming emotion. And to add on to the fact that his brothers are remorseful and he's finding out about it for the first time, he also, to add on to that emotion, he also probably sees for the first time how good his God is to put him in this situation. Let me explain. We talked about last week, he learned all those lessons about God through his trials and he's thankful for it. But in this moment, he probably realizes, oh my gosh, God, you put me in a place where during this famine, I am able to provide food for my very brothers that threw me into slavery. Because of slavery, because of prison, because of all the stuff that I went through, you put me in a position where I was able to provide for the people that hated me the most. You gave me the chance to exemplify your love that you had for me to them. So don't you see what's happening here? Is Joseph was realizing this. And how this relates to us is this, is God is going to, through your seasons of change and through your trials and through all these ups and downs, God is going to put you in a place, in an opportunity. He's going to give you the chance to where you're going to be able to exemplify the love of God, the love that God has for you to the people that are closest to you. Joseph grew up with these people. He had to go all the way into slavery and into Egypt in order to get this opportunity to love them the way that he is. Isn't God so cool? It's so cool to see how God has such control and perfect timing since the very beginning of his story, and Joseph starts to see it in this moment. You can clap, yeah, God is good. By the way, when God gives you that opportunity, we also see that Joseph never has to even say a word about God. He just gets to show the love of God by living his life. He doesn't have to stand up on a stage like I'm doing. He doesn't have to hold a mic to share the love of God. He just gets to live his life in pursuit of God, and through the opportunities, God's going to shine through him. You see that? Isn't that cool? So God's sovereignty, if it wasn't already clear in Joseph's life, it is now. And Joseph is overwhelmed and all this stuff. So he comes back into the room with his brothers, wiping his face off, catching his breath still. And he put their brother Simeon into prison. Remember the deal? One of you has to stay here, one of you has to go. So he puts his brother Simeon in prison, sends them on their way with their food and with their money. He hid their money in their bags and said, you can have it both. They get home, start talking to their father, telling them the whole story. Like, man, this guy is crazy. Like, he put us in prison for 3 days, and then he kept Simeon, and he wants us to come back, and he gave us our money and our food. We promised we didn't steal it, and he accused us of being spies and tells them this whole crazy story. And his dad's like, yeah, I'm sure. Like, he, you know, like, I don't believe it. He doesn't trust them because they're asking him, can you let us bring Benjamin back? And he's like, absolutely not. Zero way. So he doesn't let them, but they, like, time and time again, they keep begging their father, please let us go. Also, to the point where one of the sons is like, look, I promise you that I'll get Benjamin back to you. If not, you can kill my two sons. Literally, he says, like, if I don't get your son back, you can kill my two sons. And I picture, I don't know if this has actually happened, but this is how I picture it, and I think it's kind of funny. Because I don't know if you've ever seen, like, the kids, like, back their dad up with, like, everything. It's like, yeah, they don't even know what they're talking about, but they're, like, fighting, like, my dad's awesome kind of thing. And so it's, like, the dad fighting, and they're, like, he's, like, you need to let us have your son. And the two kids are back here, like, hiding around. I'm like, yeah. Like, we're gonna bring your son back. It's going to be awesome. And our brother. And they're, like, yeah. He's, like, and if not, you could kill my two sons. They're, like, you, what? Like, hold up. Like, like, I don't know if that's how it happened, but that's how I picture it. But he does. So finally, some time passes, the famine gets worse, and the dad's like, fine, you can take Benjamin, take double money to pay back what you stole, what you say was given to you, and to pay for the new food, and here, bring gifts, this is insurance. Basically, they're super terrified of Joseph because they think he's just some crazy Egyptian dude. So he says, go, take him back, but just make sure that you get my son back. Make sure that he comes back. So he says, he sends them all, the 11, or the other 10, Simeon's still in prison. It says in verse 16, when Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to a steward of his house, bring the men into the house and slaughter an animal and make ready for the men. to dine with me at noon. So Joseph was so happy that his little brother was there that he threw a feast, threw a massive party, invited him into his own personal house, which was really rare for Egyptians at the time. And the first thing that they did when they got there was that they went to his servant, his assistant, and said, look, here's what happened. We found the money in our bags. We promise you we didn't steal it. Here's all the extra money that you, like, that we want to buy more food. And here's gifts just to prove that we're loyal, all this stuff. Speaking to his servant, and his servant says this, peace to you. Don't be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has put the treasure in your sacks for you. Two things we notice here. One, God gets the credit again. God gets all the glory. The second thing is this. This is Joseph's servant speaking, not Joseph. This is an Egyptian servant proclaiming the name of God. Why? Because of how fearful of God Joseph has lived his life over the past 9 years, that his servant himself starts to not only believe in the power and the sovereignty of God, but starts to proclaim it himself. So your faith in God and the way you live in pursuit of him has way more impact than you realize it does. There was never a moment probably where Joseph sat him down and was like, you need to believe this, you need to proclaim the name of God, or you're going to hell. No, Joseph just lived his life in pursuit of God, and because of it, his servant picked up on it, had faith himself, so much so that he started proclaiming the name of God himself. Isn't that cool? Yeah. So servant starts proclaiming the name of God. And then it says they went to Joseph's dining room and they had this party. And when they did, they bowed themselves before Joseph and presented these gifts to him. And in that moment, it all comes back around and makes sense. They were fulfilling the dream that Joseph had when he was a kid. Technically, this dream has already been fulfilled metaphorically because Joseph was in authority over them. But now physically, they're on their faces bowing down to him, presenting gifts. And all of a sudden, Joseph's dream is fulfilled. It becomes true. So that's just a cool moment. But Joseph sat him at the table according to their birth order, from oldest to youngest, which confused them because once again, they think this is just some crazy Egyptian dude. Probably creeped him out even a little bit more. They're like, how? This guy's been stalking me on Insta. Like, I need to block this dude. Sits him down. He does it for two reasons. One, to set up another dramatic effect for when he finally reveals that it's brother. Like, ta-da, like I'm your brother. And then also as evidence, because there's probably going to be a moment where they don't believe him. And they're like, well, then how did I sit you like this, you know, kind of thing. So he does it for that reason, sits him in order. And while they're eating, he decides now's the moment to test them. So in chapter 44, verse 1 through 2, it says that he commanded the steward of his house, his servant, fill the men's sacks with the food that they came for and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack and put my cup, the silver cup. Now I'm going to stop there because the fact that he specifies that it's his cup means that it's super special to him. Like, I don't know if you've ever had a thing that is really probably not very valuable to the rest of the world, but is like super valuable to you. Like, it means everything. Like, for me growing up, I don't know why, but I had a chair in the living room that like no one touched. I was like, if you touch the chair, you get off my chair. Like, this is my chair. This is Joseph's cup. Don't touch the cup. But Joseph says, take that cup, my cup, that special cup that I have, and put it in the mouth of the sack of the youngest with his money. And so he did as Joseph did, and so told him to do him. And the reason that this is significant, the reason that he put it in Benjamin's sack, the youngest, is that he was trying to discover his brother's attitudes toward him. He was setting them up. He was framing his little brother for stealing, and he was going to see how the older brothers reacted to it. Say if they let him, you know, get captured or whatever, they don't love him. But if they defend him, then they love him. And he was also making sure that there was no room for them to accuse him when they found out that it was him, right? Because if he took the cup and put it in one of the other brothers and then revealed himself, they'd have been like, well, you're just trying to get revenge at us, you know. But Benjamin had nothing to do with him getting sold into slavery. So by putting it in his bag, they had no room to be able to accuse him of retaliating. Does that make sense? So they put it in Benjamin's sack, and then the next day, he sent a servant after him and said, all right, go, accuse him of stealing, do the whole spiel. So they get there, accuse him of stealing. They're like, no, we didn't steal anything, we promise. In fact, we're so innocent that whoever it is, if you find the cup here, you can just kill that person. You can kill him, and the rest of us will be your slaves. Like, we did not do it. So they cut open the sacks, oldest to youngest. They get all the way to Benjamin's, cut it open. Sure enough, there's the cup. And it says that they got so stressed that they literally tore their clothes. I don't know if you've ever had that stress where it's you itch and you sweat and you pace and you're like, I don't even know what to do. I don't know where to start. How am I going to tell my dad that I failed that test again? What am I going to do? Starts itching. And literally it says that they tore their clothes because they couldn't stand it. They left every single thing that they had, all the food, all the money, got on their horses and went straight back to Egypt to explain it to Joseph. They got so stressed out because like, we can't lose our little brother. So they get there, they go, they bow down before Joseph again, crying to him, begging to him once again for fulfilling the dream, only this time to a higher extent, literally crying, begging him, please don't do it. And Judah, the oldest brother, comes forward, or I think he's the oldest brother, actually, I don't know that, I just made that up. He's one of the brothers. I didn't want to like go and study that later and realize that I was completely wrong. Comes forward to Joseph and makes this huge long speech. So long so, it says that in the book of Genesis, there is no other text as long as this one. It's the longest text in the entire book of Genesis from one person, quote from one person. And that's significant because Egyptians loved long speeches. I know that sounds funny, but I studied it and apparently it was like a sign of like organization. They like loved it. Like organization was like their love language. I don't know what it was, but like, so the fact that he made this huge long speech pleading to him meant that he was really trying as hard as he could. It says, please don't take our brother. Let him go and take all the rest of us. Joseph gives him another chance, saying, no, 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 you guys can all go free. I just want that guy. And they're like, no, please, no, don't take him, whatever. And it says in that moment that Joseph, again, same word, wept, was overwhelmed with emotion again because he realized they don't hate him. They've changed. They really hated so much what they did to me that they love the other brother that they hated. They've changed. And it says in verse 2-3, and he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard it. He cried so loud that the houses around him heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, I'm Joseph. Is my father alive? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Can you imagine a moment like that where you think your brother's been dead? The brother that you sold into slavery, by the way, has been dead for 15, 20 years, and all of a sudden this guy, this crazy Egyptian dude, takes off the metaphorical mask and is like, surprise, it's me. How do you believe him? Are you shocked? Do you run? Do you hug him? Like, I don't know. They didn't know either. But he comforted him, said, embrace me, and don't feel bad about that. Don't feel bad about what you did to me so many years ago. Joseph said to his brothers, come near to me, please. And they came near, and he said, I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt, and now don't be distressed or angry with yourself because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. Basically, don't worry about what you did. It's bigger than us anyway. It's bigger than you. It's bigger than me. God had it all planned out. Don't worry about it. So he starts to preach. He starts to like really start revving. He's like, here we go. This is my chance to talk to him about what God's done in my life. So his brothers start to see God's sovereignty too. Because they've been in the dark this whole time, it says in verse 6-8, for the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years to go in which there will be neither plowing or harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep for you alive so many survivors. So he starts to explain to them the seriousness of the moment, because they just think it's been a bad couple of years. They don't understand that there's still five to go. But Joseph's like, no, you don't even understand. It's bigger than you think. It's not just going to stop next season. It's going to keep going and keep going. And God put me here so that I was able to provide food for the whole world and for you. And God did this in me and God did that in me. And he starts to explain to him, it's bigger than what you think it is. So it's not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and a lord of all the house and a ruler over the land of Egypt. He went further explaining to him, not only did God give me this chance to provide food to the world, God also put me here so that I could be even more powerful than Pharaoh and proclaim the name of God. I could be the ruler over all of Egypt and proclaim the name of God. He's saying, guys, don't feel bad. I should even thank you because God put me in this place so that I could be the most powerful man in the world, not for my sake, but for his. He starts to preach to him. He says, don't you see what God's doing? He starts explaining, this is what happened through my trials. Don't feel bad about it. I don't know if you see what's happening here. Joseph's giving his testimony. Joseph's giving his story to his brothers, because his brothers really aren't even brothers at this point. They're strangers pretty much. But Joseph starts telling his story in the perspective of what God has done for him. This is a testimony. This is Joseph talking about, here's what God's done in me. Here's all the lessons that I've learned. Here's what he's doing in me right now. All because of him. And through this whole thing, he's not doing it for the sake of catching his brothers up. He's doing it for the sake of, look how cool our God is. and starts preaching to him and starts giving him this testimony. This is his testimony, and my point in this is saying is that God uses our stories to be able to relate to others and to communicate God's love to them. He uses our stories for that. He puts us in opportunities where our stories, whatever it is going to be able to relate to those people. That story is a cool story, but the fact that his brothers are starving in that moment, the story means so much more. And the fact that they get to see the God that's in it means so much more to him. It's pretty cool. So what I want to talk to you tonight is a little bit about our stories. I want to talk about how God uses our stories and how this whole thing, this moment relates to us. And so before I do that, I want to tell you something. You don't have to have a Joseph story to have a powerful story. You don't have to go, yeah, you can clap for that. You don't have to go into slavery or be sold or go into prison, or you don't have to have a crazy up and down story to have a powerful story. The power of the story comes from the God that's within it, not from the story itself. Does that make sense? So God is going to use your story regardless, whether it's the most insane, crazy story up and down, or a pretty mild story where you didn't do anything wrong and you thought "but" was a bad word, which it is. We're not going to say it here. Thanks, JT. It doesn't matter what kind of story you have, God's going to use it. It's the power of God that makes the story relatable and incredible, not the story itself. So how do we have a story that God can use? The first thing that we need to do, and according to Joseph's story, we see it as well, is we need to find freedom from our past. You have to find freedom from your past in order for your story to become relevant. Galatians 5:1, for freedom Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and don't submit again to a yoke of slavery. A yoke was something they put on an ox where the ox would plow the field through it. If you don't know what a yoke is, that's what it is. So it's basically saying, don't let slavery put another chain around your neck. You've been set free through Christ. That's why he died for us. Don't go back into it. In other words, you're free. Don't go back. If Joseph, we talked about last week, he was set free from his past. We even mentioned it earlier. But in that moment where he saw his brothers, if he went right back to it, where he said, oh, I forgot about them, time to get revenge, he would have gone right back into the slavery that he had been set free from. Because he would have gone right back into losing sight of the God that put him in the place, in the season that he was in. Does that make sense? So you're set free from something, don't go back into it. And we also know that if Joseph had gone back into it, if he had been bitter still, if he had never been set free from his past, one, he wouldn't be giving to God the glory right now. He wouldn't be talking about how cool his God is. Two, he'd probably still be stuck in prison because he would never have seen the opportunity within the trial. He never would have given God the glory. He had to find freedom from his past first. By the way, cool little side note, not a side note, it's actually really important. Thanks, Laura. Is that freedom from our past isn't just freedom from our sin. Yes, we have to have freedom from our sin. Scripture talks about being freed from our sin. But it's not just that, it's anything in our past. Sometimes it's something that you did, like sin. Sometimes it's something that's been done to you. In this one, we see that he tells his brothers, you gotta find freedom from what you did to me, from the sin that you did, find freedom from it. That guilt, that shame, let it go. Find freedom from it. But in Joseph's perspective, it's something that was done to him. He was wronged, but he had to find freedom from it still. It's not just the thing that you've done, it's the things that have been done to you, whether that's sexually abused. That's not something that you did, that's something that was done to you. You still have to find freedom from it. Verbally abused. Maybe you were just wronged by some friends. They treated you awful and you're still holding on to that bitterness, that grudge. You got to find freedom from it. That was one for me not too long ago. You have to find freedom from it. Excuse me. We have to find freedom from our past. The second thing is this. We have to find God in our seasons. We have to find God in our seasons. Psalms 23:4-6. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For you are with me. Your rod, your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. In other words, don't find comfort in the season, find comfort in your God. You have got to be able to find God in the seasons, and if your comfort is in the seasons, What happens when that season gets taken away from you? We talk about seasons come and they go. It's never going to stay the same. So if your comfort is in the fact that right now you got it all together and you can sit back on a Friday night and watch Netflix and Saturday, go ball out with your boys or go to the beach or whatever, and you're comfortable because everything's going your way, next week something happens, you get a flat tire, you fail a test, your girlfriend breaks up with you, and all of a sudden like that, everything that you were comfortable in is gone. What happens then? Whereas if your comfort is in your God and you say, God, thank you for this chance to be able to rest and relax, or that tire pops and you, God, please get me through this trial. Your comfort is no longer in the season. Your comfort is in God. And from then on, no season that comes your way will make you uncomfortable because your comfort is not reliable on or reliant on that season. We find comfort in our God, not in our seasons, and we acknowledge that he's there. That's how we know that God's, that's how we acknowledge and make it known to him that we know he's there, is that in those seasons, comfort or discomfort, we acknowledge, God, I know you're here, and I don't necessarily know what you're doing through it, but I know you're here, and so we acknowledge that God's in it. He's present in all of our ups and downs, but Joseph had to acknowledge that God was there before he started living life to the fullest and before he started proclaiming the name of God to the people around him. He himself had to acknowledge that God was in it. Does that make sense? You have to find God in your seasons. And that's when Joseph's story started to mean something. Is when he was able to let go of his past and find God in his seasons, all of a sudden his story turns from just some sad sob story where everything went wrong to a story of, look how awesome my God is. Look how incredible he is. Look what he's doing through this. His story starts to become relevant and important, all because he was able to let go of his past and find his God in the season. That's when your story starts to become relevant. When you're able to let go of your past and find freedom from it and step forward and say, God, I know you're here. I don't understand it. I don't know where you're going with it. I don't know what you're doing, but you're here and my comfort is not in this world and there's nothing that I can do that will bring me comfort, only what you do, and that is love me, and I find my comfort in that, so I know I'll be okay regardless. And when you do that, now your story becomes relatable because there's someone next to you who's going through the exact same thing or something completely different, but it's the same emotions locked onto it, and they're hopeless and they don't know what to do, and they're just saying it's gonna be so much better when it's better, and you're saying, no, it's better right now because I know that my God has me. And you get to walk them through that. That's when your story becomes relatable and relevant to the people around you. So my call for you guys here tonight is this. Get excited. Don't be scared about the uncertainty. Don't be scared about what tomorrow brings. Don't be scared about your first semester at college. Don't be scared about summer and the relationship that you're in and it's going south. Don't be scared about what's going on. Get excited for what God's gonna do in it and in you and through it. Who knew that Joseph was gonna go on this journey where he was gonna be able to proclaim the name of God to the entire world and provide food to his very brothers that sold him into prison? No one. But it happened. And it will always happen in a way that we don't always see it, but God will always come through. And so I'm calling you to get excited about it tonight. So if you'll bow your heads, I wanna pray over this room. Dear God, we lift you up in this room. We lift you up and thank you for what you did in Joseph's life and the lesson that we get to learn from it. And thank you for what you're doing in our lives. We don't know where everything's going. We don't know where we're going to be tomorrow or next week or next year or in 5 years. We don't know how it's all going to go, but we know that you're already there. We know that you're here now, and we give you praise here now, and we will give you praise in 5 years, and we will give you praise on the good days, and we will give you praise in the bad days. But God, I pray right now that you prepare us for those moments, and I pray that we learn to get excited in you. We find our joy and our comfort in you rather than in the things of this world. As we stay in this attitude of prayer with everyone bowing their heads, I want to ask you what you're still holding on to. We talked about finding freedom from our past. We talked about the importance of letting stuff go. If Joseph had held on to that bitterness, he never would have been put in a place. He never would have taken opportunity of the place that he was in. He never would have started living his life to the fullest. So I don't know what you're holding on to tonight. We are all holding on to something, regardless of how good and churchy of a Christian you are. We're all holding on to something. What are you holding on to? Maybe it's something that's been done to you. Maybe it's an abuse. Maybe it's a bad relationship. Maybe it's, I don't know. Fill in the blank. Maybe it's something that you've done. Maybe it's a sin. Maybe it's an addiction that you're still a part of. Maybe it's some cuts on your wrist. Maybe it's something, a thought that you had of closing my eyes while I was driving down the street. Maybe it's blank. Whatever you're holding on to tonight, we all have a past, whether it's 10 years ago or 10 minutes before service started. Maybe you were in the bathroom and you were looking at something on your phone that you shouldn't have been looking at, but you can't seem to put it down. You can't seem to let it go. What are you holding on to? You need to find freedom from your past. So whatever it is that you're holding on to, I'm going to give you a chance in a second to let it go and to give it to God. When we give things to God, the weight of that thing, shame, guilt, anxiety, depression, whatever it is, whatever that weight that's on your shoulders that says, I can't get rid of this thing and here's the result of it, but for some reason, no matter how painful and bad it is, I can't seem to let go of it. It says when we finally let go of it and give it to God, that weight is lifted off our shoulders because no longer is the burden on us. Now the burden is on the cross that Jesus died and rose again and found victory on. So it's lifted off your shoulders when you give it to God, and we're able to find freedom through Christ. And I'm about to lead you in that prayer where you'll get a chance to let go of that thing that you're holding on to. You'll get to find freedom through Jesus. So in just a second, if that's you, I'm going to ask you to repeat this prayer after me and mean it in your heart. And when you surrender it all to God, that weight is lifted off your shoulders and it says you find freedom. You're renewed, you're redeemed. That thing is no longer even a part of your past. Now that thing is just a part of the testimony of God. It is not even a part of what makes you, you. It's not even saying, you can't even say, I used to struggle with this. You said before I was saved, my old self struggled with this. It says that you're a new creation when we surrender it to God. So if that's you, just repeat this prayer after me under your breath or in your mind or whatever it is, just mean it in your heart. Say, God, come into my heart. Wash me clean. Make me new. I give you my life. I let go of my past. Give me freedom. Forgive me for everything I've done. Give me purpose in everything I do. I surrender it all to you. I love you. Amen. Amen. Hey, can we clap our hands for anyone who said that prayer for the first time tonight?